Good afternoon, Juno, and welcome to Juno Afternoon. Pat Moore, your host today. It's about 3 minutes after, about 3 o'clock, all right on the nose. And today on the show, we've got quite an active little group coming toward us. Folks from Pavitt's Gym will be here to talk about a upcoming seminar that they're planning on doing on eating the right way. Holly Andrus, Alaska Positive Juror, will drop in. John Kelly will be here to tell us about the Alaska Seafood Festival coming up. Suzanne Williams, I'm sorry, Pat Harris, will be heard on our sustainability segment today talking about her composting operation at the community gardens. And some folks from JDHS and TMHS will come by to tell us about Friday's college fair at those schools. The weather looks like, it looks like fog, and then it looks like rain, and then it looks like rain developing into snow tomorrow, and then Thursday, cloudy with scattered rain showers. But guess what? Through the weekend, it says mostly cloudy, and it does not say rain or snow. Isn't that nice?
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez in Anchorage, Alaska. Alaska Native elders and youth focus on Native knowledge at the 2012 Elders and Youth Conference in Anchorage. That knowledge includes language. Mary Hawkinson is an Aleutic speaker from Old Harbor.
It's important that our kids learn the language because I spoke it all my life since I don't know how old, but I'm a fluent speaker. There's about 14 of us fluent speakers left, I think, 14 at home.
Hawkinson helps teach the language in her community. She also uses it at home.
My kids understand what I say, but they can't speak it right. You know, they'll understand me. Because it was hard when we went to school. We couldn't speak Aleut in school. But I told my teacher that's not going to stop me from speaking my language. So here I am today.
Candace Branson is speaking and learning the Aleutic language.
Languages don't die in healthy communities. And learning a language is a challenging process. It requires relationships. It requires relationships to stay alive. And there has to be so much more than the language that is coming up with it. There's community building and development and positive conflict resolution and just healthy relationships to support that language. It also brings with it the cultural understanding of who we are when we speak our language.
Branson says there are many language programs in Kodiak which she helps teach.
We are geared towards really young kids and preschool level, high schoolers, and adults learning language. So my process was I came to a language gathering and a friend asked if she could help me and had me come over to her house every Saturday. And we started learning the basics. And with her help and support, I started to speak more and more along with our elders in our community. So we've really gotten to grow our little fellowship of learners and speakers into a larger group.
There are a little more than half a dozen Alaska Native languages being spoken at the conference. New policies issued at the Department of Justice aim to clarify the possession and use of eagle feathers and parts by Native Americans. Tristan Autone has more.
The new Department of Justice policy essentially gives deference to Native Americans who possess non-commercial quantities of eagle parts and feathers used for personal, religious, or cultural use. In other words, officials investigating violations of federal laws, like the protection of bald and golden eagles, would leave Native people alone. Katie Jackman Tyndall is staff attorney for the National Congress of American Indians.
No huge statutory changes, but rather internal policy. And so it's all a matter of how we're still going to have to rely on DOJ to implement this policy in a way that is not detrimental to tribal members who are using and possessing eagle feathers.
Tyndall says among the changes in policy, tribal IDs instead of permits would be viewed as sufficient to prove possession of eagle parts, and increased consultation and oversight will be implemented between U.S. attorneys and the Department of Justice's Environmental and Natural Resources Division when prosecution becomes an option. As well, prosecutors are now encouraged to consider if cases may be more appropriately handled by tribal authorities instead of federal officials. And Department of Justice officials can also exercise discretion when choosing to prosecute members of federally recognized or non-recognized tribal members in possession of eagle parts. For National Native News, I'm Tristan Ottone.
On this day in 2011, Eloise Cobell, the lead plaintiff of the class action lawsuit Cobell versus Salazar, died after battling cancer. The Blackfeet woman led the more than a decade-long legal battle against the federal government over mismanagement of individual Indian trust accounts. The suit ended with a more than $3 billion settlement. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
5 1/2 minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. My first guest on Juneau Afternoon today is the owner, operator, and a guy who knows all about a lot of stuff having to do with fitness. Corey Pavitt's here with me. Hi, Corey.
Thanks for having me.
So you got a seminar series going on, and you got one coming up Thursday night, right?
Yeah, pretty much every Thursday at 6:30 p.m. we've got a seminar going on, and they're always free and open to all the public.
And what's this one about this week?
This one is, I believe it's titled exactly, Low Carbs, the Healthy Way, or Low Carbs, the Right Way.
Mm. Who's doing it?
I'll be doing that.
Oh, okay. And so what is the right way to do low carb? Do we have to go to the lecture?
6:30 Thursday, I'll tell you all about it.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, so I'll give you a couple of teasers now.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, you know, there's a lot of controversy, or not controversy, but maybe misunderstanding, and I very seldom use the term low carb when I'm explaining to people how they should be eating, because it sounds like a fad diet or, you know, something, you know, Atkins, of course, comes to mind. And I've always preached that you should be eating whole foods, go back to the way that the food is grown and the way it's intended to be eaten. So I'll be talking about how all that fits together and the all the benefits of eating that way. And certainly anybody who everyone should be eating that way, because that's the whole food way. But certainly anybody who's leaning towards being diabetic, the pre-diabetics, or someone who is diabetic, obviously, anybody who would like to shed a few pounds, absolutely, it's the easiest and most effective way to go about it and the healthiest way to go about it.
There's a real puzzle here because we live in Juneau, Alaska, where it is somewhat difficult to eat local sometimes somewhat difficult to eat whole food. We have a reasonable source with at least one grocery store or a few grocery stores doing organic things like that. But Whole Foods is a problem here.
Well, I actually have to disagree with you there.
Okay.
I think that organic is wonderful, and I think that that's certainly the ideal. And eating local, of course, is the ideal also. But, of course, and in that regard, we've got the fish and game. So we've really got a leg up on some really, really nutritious food that way. But if you're not a hunter or a fisherman, or if you're not a successful hunter or fisherman, then we're stuck with the grocery stores. But there's certainly, you know, nowadays the fruits and vegetables that we get in Juneau are really as good as anywhere else, pretty much. And so or organic, yes, that's difficult to eat entirely organic, and it's going to be hard to eat entirely local. But you certainly eat this way very, very easily here in Juneau.
Hmm. I may have to come to your lecture and find out how you're suggesting to do it. I know that week after week I go to grocery stores around town and look at things that are there, and I think I could grow better than that. I wish I had time to do it all.
Yeah, that's. I don't know that I could with my black thumbs, but here in Juneau anyway. Certainly, it's a treat to get stuff out of your garden.
Now, I've been spending a lot of time out at the community gardens doing some interviews. We're going to hear one of them later on in the show today about composting. So there's quite an active group out there that does a lot of growing. It's amazing what comes up out of the ground in that garden patch mm-hmm. out there. So there are some other things going on, too. I think this is the weekend when season pass sign up for Eagle Crest comes up.
Yeah, we're doing a partnership this year with Eagle Crest, and one of the things that we're doing is that you can go get your season pass or get your photo taken at Pavitt Health and Fitness on Saturday at noon to 3, I believe it is.
Noon to 3.
And so I know that I understand the first day of the of the season for all the people itching to get up there. There's a big long line to get your photos taken if you'd bought your photo online. So if you live in the valley, or if you want to come out and get a workout in and get a season pass all at one time, but you don't have to work out. Come on in.
Okay, and there's a giveaway involved.
Yeah, a couple giveaways. Yeah. We'll be giving a 1 month membership to Pavitt Health and Fitness, and Eagle Crest, I believe, is giving what they call a learn to ski package.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, a good chance to do something here. So
and that's going on now. If you stop by any time now, you can sign up for and get into that drawing. So that's not only from 12 to 3 on Saturday when you're with the season passes, but you can simply stop in any time and put your name in the basket for that.
Now, under the assumption that there may be one person listening to us who doesn't know where Pavitt Health and Fitness is, you want to give directions?
Sure. we used to say it was next to Job Service at 10 Mile on Glacier Highway. I heard a radio ad for Job Service one time saying that it was next to Pavitt Health and Fitness. So I said, we've arrived. But it is, you go out the road, you pass Don Abel's on the left-hand side, and you just go half a mile further, and you'll see our big sign on the left-hand side of the road.
Real good. The seminar on Thursday night starts at?
At 6:30 p.m.
Is there a charge for those seminars?
There is no charge.
Okay. So, once you're in, are you just there for the seminar, or is it possible to check out the facility as well?
Oh, sure. If you get there a little early, we'd love to give you a tour. And we're really open about if you haven't been there before and you want to do a workout and just see how the place works for you, that'd certainly be totally acceptable. So come early or stay late. That's fine.
Good enough. Corey Pavitt from Pavitt Health and Fitness out at 10 Mile next to Job Service, or Job Service is next to
exactly.
Pavitt, so whichever way you want to go with that. Thursday night, 7 o'clock.
Thank you so much.
music off of a very interesting album that has the same songs in two parts. The first is jazz, and the second is traditional Tlingit music. So these are all Tlingit songs that have been sent to jazz. The title of the album is Ed Littlefield Walking Between Worlds. So, it's 14 minutes and a half after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News. This is Juno Afternoon. Pat Moore, your host today, and I have two lovely ladies sitting here in front of me who are not both from Juno. With me is Holly Andrus, who is the juror for the Alaska Positive Competition. She's going to be giving a lecture here in Juno, a couple of them, and she's here to do some judging. And with her is Jackie Manning from the museum. So, hi, Jackie.
Hi.
Hi, Holly.
Hi.
Yeah, so welcome aboard. Jackie, what's Holly going to do while she's up here?
Well, so she's giving a lecture tomorrow, and she's also going to do the final juring of the photographs that have been sent in, and then she's going to fly up to Anchorage on Friday and give a lecture up there Friday night at 7 at the University of Anchorage.
So the reason I went to Holly or to Jackie first is because Holly tells me that she left Portland at 3 o'clock this morning, so she's staggering, or got up at 3 o'clock this morning to catch flights. So she's staggering under the load, but we're going to see if we can get through her glazed eyes. And so what are you going to talk about at the lecture?
Well, I'm going to be giving an artist talk where I'll be discussing really the historical trajectory of my work since graduate school, and primarily talking about three substantial bodies of work and my particular and, you know, perhaps unique approach to photography and how it might be different than how most people might perceive the photographic process.
In what ways?
Well, to use a distinction coined by the Canadian photographer Jeff Wall, I'm more of a farmer than a hunter when it comes to photography. So if a hunter is someone who waits for these kind of beautiful or uncanny or interesting moments to manifest and then captures them with their camera, I rather cultivate and craft them. And so my work is in the realm of constructed narrative. So I'm more influenced by cinema, quite frankly. And so oftentimes my preparation for just a single photograph might be similar to the preparation for the scene of a film. So I think about a narrative. There's always some sort of implied narrative, cinematic lighting, characters that get, to some degree, some direction from me, and thinking a lot about my art direction, color combinations, composition, and all those variables.
Is there the danger when you do what you're talking about that you lead the viewer of the photograph too far and don't leave them space to be in the photograph?
Well, I think that's the challenge. I think that finding that middle ground where, you know, all of my work tends to be about something that's important to me, something that I feel is worth enshrining photographically. And usually it comes from some sort of a pivotal life experience or childhood memory or whatever. And so that challenge of how do you serve up enough so that the viewer's not completely bewildered, but how do you hold back so that they can still arrive at their own assumptions and aha moments and feel like it's more of an interactive experience for them?
See, that the reason I ask the question is because that's exactly the challenge that I have to do when I do radio drama, which
yeah.
I do some of. And the trick is to stay back away from the subject enough so that the listener can provide their own soundscape. And then
sure.
you give them the clues.
Uh-huh.
But they're the ones who are creating the world.
Uh-huh.
And I was curious because of what you were saying. I was trying to figure, you know, if you give them too much, then basically they have nothing. They'll look at it and they don't get a chance to dive in and participate.
Yeah. And one of the things that's been interesting for me is, you know, when you make work in the academic realm, you have that privilege of standing up in front of your work and saying, this is what this photo is about, and this is what I was trying to communicate to the viewer. But then after you graduate and you start making work in the public sphere, you have to relinquish that control, and people arrive at your work with their own life experiences and connotations, and it may be completely oppositional to your intention, but at the same time, that's really the power of art. So if you can find a way to make your work like universal and accessible, but still have it come from this sincere place. And of course, I don't want to make a sweeping generalization that this is everybody's motivation for art making, but I feel like usually I craft a photo or a series because I have some sort of important story that I want to tell the world.
So what's your own judgment of your success at it?
Well, I think, like most artists, there's a degree of self-doubt and criticism that's a friend for life. And I think that that's part of what makes part of being a competent artist, part of having the gift as an artist is to have a discernible and critical eye. And if I felt like every photo I ever made was the best that it could have been, and I was completely satisfied with it, I just don't know if I would continue making art. And I've never had that experience, so maybe that's an experience I'm chasing down.
Now that Holly has made this incredible case for going to her lecture,
when's it going to be and where? So tomorrow night at the Alaska State Museum, so Wednesday night, October 17th, at 7 p.m., and it's free entry. And then in Anchorage, it is Friday, October 19th at 7 p.m. at the University of Anchorage in their art room.
At the UAA art room. Okay.
Yes.
And then Alaska Positive, you've already collected the things that Holly is here to judge, and she'll be working on that while she's among us.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, in the midst of all that, I hope you have a chance to get around Juneau. We've ordered up some very unusual Juneau weather. It's going to rain, and I know that it never does that here, so I apologize.
It never rains in Portland.
Yeah, I know. So you're in good shape. However, the forecast says that we'll probably have some snow tomorrow, maybe you'll get a flake on your nose. It may not get down to the street level, but nonetheless, we're supposed to have rain mixed with snow tomorrow. So I hope you have a chance to see our beautiful city. Have you been here before?
No, I haven't.
Oh.
This is my first time in Alaska, though I did have one other invitation. I'm the youngest of 10 kids, and I have 5 brothers, and my brothers and my dad are avid hunters. And so for our high school graduation gift, you could either have a month-long hunting trip in Alaska with my dad or $500 in cash. So all the boys went to Alaska and all the girls didn't.
There you go. Well, good shot. Okay, you've heard a little bit of a teaser from the lecture that'll be tomorrow night at the Alaska Museum here in Juneau. Holly Andrus will be up at 7 o'clock to talk about her art, and then she's going up to Anchorage to do the same thing on Friday, did you say?
Yes.
Friday, she'll be up there. So, and she's here to judge Alaska Positive. Welcome to Juneau.
Thanks for having me.
You bet.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 16th of October, 2012. It's the birthday of Eugene O'Neill, born in New York City in a hotel room on Broadway, 1888. His father, a famous actor, O'Neill spent much of his childhood in hotels, on trains, going with his father on tours. It was when he was 24, he fell sick with tuberculosis, spent 6 months in a sanatorium, and while there he started to read classic playwrights and start to write plays himself. He wrote 11 one-act plays. In just a few years, they were put on in Provincetown, Massachusetts, by the Provincetown Players. 1920, his play Beyond the Horizon was a big success on Broadway. Anna Christie in 1922, Strange Interlude in 1928. It's the birthday of Noah Webster, born in Hartford, Connecticut, 1758, who wrote the first American dictionary, standardizing the spelling and pronunciation of the American language. And it's the birthday of the man who said, "We are all in the gutter, but some of us are looking at the stars," Oscar Wilde, Dublin, 1854. When he was 27, he was invited to go on a lecture tour of North America, invited by the producer of Gilbert and Sullivan's new comic opera, Patience, a work which made fun of the aesthetic movement, the art for art's sake movement. The producer wasn't sure if people around America would be familiar with the thing that the opera was satirizing, and so to make it clear, they had Oscar Wilde come on tour in his purple coat to Topeka, Boston, Des Moines, Houston, St. Paul, San Francisco, and dozens of other cities. Oscar Wilde was married, he had two children, but in 1891, when he fell in love with a 22-year-old Lord Alfred Douglas Ross, he began the most productive period of his literary life. He wrote The Picture of Dorian Gray, his only novel, the year he met Alfred, wrote the play A Woman of No Importance, and The Importance of Being Earnest, wrote the first draft in just 21 days. Here's a poem for today by Stanley Plumley, a poem with an Italian term in it, Salotto Città, living city. The poem entitled Autumnal. Not long before she died, my mother told me that her one regret was never to have traveled, and that since she had just read about it, or somewhere that reminded her from some time, Venice was the place she would have gone to, and might still, in her haunting of the afterlife. She had already questioned God in heaven and the heavy Bible verses she was taught, and now saw death as her last chance to live, her last chance to spend the green gold leaf pressed into books each October on her birthday. She wept. She understood the innocence of dying. And here she was, propped up against her pillow the way she finally would be in her coffin, with her eyeglasses held between the light and open page. She wanted me to hear the article that said that Venice would be filled like all Italy that season, and that Venice in particular was vulnerable and small, weighted with the souls of travelers, and that in the Grand Canal, rivers of dark waters moved. Would there be space? It said Salotto Città, that Venice was a city the size of drawing rooms, lit with the flowers of funerals and weddings. A poem by Stanley Plumley, Autumnal, from his collection Old Heart, published by W.W. Norton and Company, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Reputation.com, helping businesses improve what potential customers find online in search engines and review sites. Learn more at Reputation.com. Written by Joy Biles, produced by Nick Vetter. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
29 minutes after 3. You're in tune with KTOO News. We're in the middle of Juneau afternoon. Pat Moore, your host today. John Kelly from the station is here to talk about the Alaska Festival of Seafood. Hi, John.
Hi. How are you doing?
So what's up?
So Saturday, we've only got a couple of minutes to do this, but I just want to give you the details. We are now doing another Alaska Festival of Seafood. It's been over 15 years we've been doing this now, and on Saturday, starting at 4 o'clock with a tutored beer tasting from the Alaskan Brewing Company, we'll be starting to serve dinner at 5, and that goes to 7:30. Those are the short details. Tickets you can get online at kto.org, or at the station, or at the door on Saturday, although it doesn't hurt to get them ahead of time. This year, again, Taku Smokeries is giving us several hundred pounds of fish that I'll be cutting up all day long on Saturday. And the Silver Bow Bakery will be providing the dessert. Usually it's some kind of a gingerbread cake made with Alaska amber. Buzz Ritter will be providing the bread. Of course, it's at the Yacht Club. And this year, for the second time in a row, Abby's Kitchen will be providing the salads. And I know last year that we ran out of greens. I think we ran out of most of the salads after a couple of hours, but the green salads went pretty fast. And I was just talking to Abby about an hour ago. She's going to be making extra green salad this year. She's making her own dressings to go with that. And, of course, she's providing some of the equipment. And she will be helping me do the actual cooking of the halibut. Grillmeister Ben Brown will be outside grilling up the salmon, and we'll grace that with our own special sauce. By the way, the halibut is halibut Katagante, and there's variations of that, but we basically use sour cream yogurt and mayonnaise and onion kind of sauce that goes over it. It's pretty good. Everybody usually enjoys it. The tutored beer tasting, of course, is at 4 o'clock if you want to show up for that. That's a kind of a separate event. You can get tickets for that and or the seafood itself. If you go to the tutored beer tasting, you can also get tickets for the fish event. But that starts at 4 o'clock, and the tutored beer tasting looks pretty interesting. I never actually get a chance to go to it myself because I start cooking around 4. The doors open for the food at 5, and that goes to 7:30. I would recommend that everyone try to get there earlier than later, because usually about 7 o'clock, as the night is starting to wear down, we start running out of the salads and the breads and all those goodies that are out there. I know the Silver Bow stuff is really good, and Buzz Ritter's bread is always good, and things start to get a little lean around 7 o'clock. So I would say, you know, think about it around 5 after you've gone to Pavitt's and done your healthy thing. And you can have some nice, healthy food.
Yeah.
Because and fish, yeah. What's better than fish in your diet? Especially
sounds
if you're
going right to
be thinking healthy on that day.
Yeah.
Just come on over to the Yacht Club. 4 o'clock for the beer tasting or 5 o'clock for the seafood festival. We haven't had any complaints in the past. Well, it's been over 15 years now. We may be pushing 20 years on this event. So come on over.
Good enough, John.
Yep.
So the event is the Alaska Festival of Seafood. The tickets at KTOO or at the door, or what was the other one place?
Online at kto.org or here at
the
station.
Or at the station or on the door. At the door, no difference in price. Three places. Advice from John, who does the cooking, show up between 4 and 5 if you want a full plate. But the event goes on until later.
Yeah, the beer tasting's at 4.
Right.
Show up early. Make sure you get your food.
Outstanding.
All you can eat.
Thanks, John.
Yep.
Well, time now for another exploration of an aspect of sustainability here in Juneau. We've been doing these on Tuesdays for the last little while here, and we'll continue through the month of October and then into November with this. Probably take a little of December off, and then we'll probably be back with more of them in January. We've been looking through this month at reducing the stream of waste that goes into the landfill here in Juneau, and we've looked at a number of different things, but this show and the next one, and I think the one after that, are all three going to be looking at aspects of composting waste that we don't have to send to the landfill, because we can use it to make soil for our own gardens. We interviewed Pat Harris at the community garden on the topic, and this is what she had to say about it. We're here with Pat Harris in the community gardens, and if you hear gunshots in the background, it's not a war zone. We're across the street from the firing range, and we're standing next to one of Pat's several plots out here. And she's going to talk to us about her composting operation. So, Pat, I'm looking at we decided about a 4x10 bed that has a whole bunch of vegetable cuttings heaped on it and black plastic ready to be put over them. What's going on here?
Well, this is my overflow composting pile. I have my other composting bins full with earlier in the season garden refuse. And so at the end of the season, I always have a lot of leftover organic stuff. So I kind of do a sheet composting on one of the beds. And this bed formerly was a garlic bed earlier in the summer, and I harvested the garlic in August. And then I planted a cover crop, and then I've turned that under, and so now I'm doing a sheet composting on top of that bed.
And you say sheet composting. What does that mean?
That means a pile of vegetable crop. And I'm going to mix it with, got some rabbit manure here to put in, and I'll have some wood shavings just to give it a little carbon. And this won't break down over the winter, but it will definitely start to decompose, and I will then empty out my other compost bins, which are basically almost finished, and I can take the finished compost out of the bins put that on the beds, and then take this unfinished compost and put it in the bins to let it finish cooking.
What is it about the composting process that changes the vegetables that we're looking at here, the vegetable cuttings, into soil? How does that work?
Miracle of nature. It's a life cycle of the living biosphere. Organic matter decays. Everything, as we know, decays, and the elements get recycled into more basic materials that can be reused by other living things.
So normally that would take longer over time. You speed it up with the composting process?
We try to, by having the right combinations of kind of green materials, and which are rich in nitrogen, and then carbonaceous materials, which are rich in carbon. Those are called the brown materials, we call them. And the right mixture you get, it's kind of it's like a cocktail. It's the right brew to encourage microorganisms to break down the organic stuff.
How do you find out what the right brew is?
It's kind of experimental, and you can look in a lot of garden publications. They will tell you kind of what the ratios are. Some things are naturally balanced so that you can pretty well compost them without mixing with other things. But usually it's like 20 to 1, like 20 parts carbon to 1 part nitrogen, something like that. I could be mistaken, so nobody rush out and measure your compost trying to do it that way. But there's lots of information online, especially from, I think there's a Cornell site that I've referred to several times. There's a Master Composter program, actually, that's kind of comparable to Master Gardener program, and you can enroll in this 40 hours of composting instruction if you're really dedicated. And so far I haven't gone quite that far, but I think if it were available locally, I might go for it.
Now, your garden plots are largely there is this compost worked into all of your garden plots.
Pretty well, and it depends on what I'm going to be growing next year as to which plots I will put more compost into. The one that we have the sheet composting on. That's going to be mostly green material, so we'll be growing lettuce, chard, kale, leafy vegetables as opposed to root crops. So they usually need more nitrogen, and so that's going to be the nitrogen-rich bed.
Well, I'm noticing here it's October, and you have wonderful plants still nice and green and healthy here in your garden plots.
That's because I haven't gotten around to harvesting them all yet, and the frost hasn't really knocked them all down. But some of them are, you know, really quite frost-hardy. The rutabagas are still looking good. The carrots are okay. Parsnips are, you know, it's you're better to wait until this time of the year to pick them, or even later, because they get better with frost. So I'm not too far behind schedule.
Pat, there's a stage two to this composting over at the bin. Could we take a look at that? So we're standing in front of a black plastic bin that's about the size of a 50-gallon oil drum, and Pat just removed the lid from it. There's some plastic down in here that mostly, I think, is to cover the top to keep water out.
It's also a place to store the plastic. If I were more efficient, I'd have this over the top of the whole structure and bungeed down so that it wouldn't get so wet in there, and I will do that for winter time because I don't want it to get any wetter.
Now, down inside this bin is some lovely-looking, I guess, cooked compost or finished compost is what you referred to it
as? I wouldn't say this is quite finished yet, okay, because you can still see the straw in it, the hay. And this is from last summer's, a lot of this hay is from last summer's kids' activity where we had a peanut penny find for the harvest fair. And after that, I usually try to get some of the hay from that, and I use it to mulch my garlic in the fall, and then when garlic starts coming in the spring, I put that hay into the compost. So this is this is about a year and a half old in here with the vegetable stuff from that fall. So
now you have a number of compost bins throughout the garden. Do you have finished compost in any of them at this point?
Yeah, I can show you. I've got three bins here plus the sheet compost, and then there's another container of stuff that's pretty well finished. And this is this would have been probably from at least 6 months before, although it looks pretty coarse still, too, but it's basically better in better shape. If you dig down, you can see it's a lot more composted than the last batch.
This compost that we're looking at now is in a gray garbage can, a plastic garbage can, probably recycled from when they when they
exactly
changed out the cans here.
Yes, I went along the street where I lived and harvested. I not only recycle organic materials, I recycle plastic as much as I can. So, yeah, I really scored on old garbage cans.
So now this looks like soil. It has a little bit of straw in it and like that. But we're looking at dirt here that your composting process has made for you.
And so you can see it's got worms in it and still a few peanut shells from the old hay penny find for the kids. But basically it's good enough to put, finished enough to put on the beds. And hopefully I will do that this winter maybe, or I could wait until spring and put it on.
Pat, is there any problem with smell or bears or bugs when you're composting?
Well, take a whiff.
Well, I don't smell anything except good soil. So
yeah, so as I said, this is pretty well finished. The other one you just looked at is you know, not smelly either. I think this one is the most recent one that I've done, and so we'll take a look at that
okay.
one. This one is I constructed this about a month ago.
And these are kits that you get, that you construct these from?
I think you can buy them disassembled is probably how you would buy them.
Mm-hmm.
These I've inherited from different people, and so I've always gotten them. They're recycled compost.
Recycled. Ooh. Okay, so this is fresh stuff here.
This is more fresh. Yeah, mm-hmm. I can see I've added some stuff here even in just the last couple of weeks.
But again, not really an objectionable smell or anything like that.
No, it's not, but it's definitely not broken down. It's got, this has got chicken manure, wood shavings, garden refuse, and brewer's yeast, brewer's grain. But it's got a long ways to go yet, so this probably won't be ready until maybe middle of next summer. But boy, it got really nice and warm. It got really hot. This one is with a hot bin.
Mm-hmm.
Most of what I do is usually pretty cold because I don't build it all at once, and this one I kind of made all at once, and it got fairly warm, so it should break down. It should be good by middle of next year, I think. This is a recycled 50-gallon drum that somebody made a homemade composter out of it and left it here, so I've appropriated it. I'm not entirely happy with the design because I don't think it gets enough air. I did drill some holes in the end here, but...
this is a plastic bin of some kind.
Yeah, plastic drum. So, but it eventually it'll work.
And someone's cut a lid into it and then just put snap catches on the a thing with a piano hinge across
and
the top of the lid.
On an axle so it will turn. You can spin it like some of the more expensive commercial ones you can buy.
And that's basically to stir the ingredients.
Yeah, you just turn it like this.
Yeah, Pat is grabbing the edges of this 50-gallon drum on the axle and kind of turning it, and you can hear the... you can hear the soil
clunking
inside.
It's very wet. I haven't gotten a good method yet to keep it from getting too wet. I've tried to put plastic over this, and it works until the plastic blows off. That was the piece of plastic you saw on the other bin that came off of this one. So, yeah, it needs some fine refinements, but it's basically another way to...
I guess I have one question, and that is, if someone were thinking of beginning composting, what would they need for the minimum composting operation?
Kind of depends on your situation, I think, where you live, what the danger of animals getting into it is. Some of the most successful ones have been pallets, built out of pallets, but then it's pretty open to animals getting into it, so... kind of depends on where you are. I like these plastic ones because they contain it in a confined space rather than just having a big pile of stuff. So that's why I don't like to leave stuff in the sheet composting too long, because it's just not as compact and efficient. You can't control it as well. So you need some kind of a good place that's well drained. You don't want it to be sitting in a puddle of water. That's one of my problems is things get awfully wet, and you got to try to keep them. It's nice to be damp. You want them like a sponge, but you don't want them to be dripping wet. So.
And if someone composted and didn't have a garden space, what could they do with the compost?
Oh, boy.
Are you interested in taking it? Would you be? Would you garden it?
I've had people donate it to me. We can't accept it at the garden. We just don't have a good system for communal composting out here. I would really love to see Juno get into communal composting, and I know that is a tremendously big project, and I know that some groups have talked about it. Thanks. Get out of the drip.
Yeah.
We don't need to go in the puddle either. I don't know. Hopefully there's some solution. I know Gustavus has had some success with it. I've had people call me up and given me compost, and I have people that leave it in my car. But I'm pretty well maxed out myself, so I can't really offer to take any. But I think it's... I'm sorry, I'm going to wax rather mystical here, but I think it's almost a spiritual experience. it's part of gardening to me. You're just cycling things through and back into the ground, and to shortcut that, I think is too bad, because you're missing out on that part of the cycle. If you're going to substitute with chemicals, it's just not as... It just doesn't grab me the way, knowing that I'm growing stuff in stuff that I used to grow stuff in. Does that make any sense? But
certainly
yeah.
Does.
Okay.
Pat, thank you very, very much for the tour, and
you're
thank
welcome.
You for the education on composting. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for your interest, and I encourage anybody that wants to try it to try it, because and worm composting is a whole other topic, and I hope you're talking to somebody about that, too.
We're going to be.
Very good.
Worm topic is indeed coming up. We're going to do a later show that involves the kids at the Montessori school who are using worm composting to clean up the leftovers from lunches. So we'll be adding that to the series on sustainability. Pat made a couple of references in there, and she didn't have a computer out at the garden. The correct ratio of carbon to nitrogen should be 30 to 1, not 20 to 1, as she mentioned. I kind of caught her on the spot there. And that Cornell website is a wonderful site. If you're interested in subjects of composting, just Google Cornell composting and you'll wind up probably in the middle of their slideshow, which is really quite entertaining. So that is our segment on sustainability. Let's listen to Bird Note.
note. Some ducks don't sound like ducks at all. Some, like the harlequin, squeak, earning them the nickname of sea mice. Harlequins are unique in the duck world in other ways as well. Alone among North American waterfowl, harlequins breed along fast-flowing rivers and streams. Quick and agile in rushing white water, they dive to the bottom of mountain streams for food. What kind of name is harlequin for a duck? If you're lucky enough to spot one of these rare birds in winter, perhaps along a rocky shore of the Puget Sound in Washington or Penobscot Bay in Maine, you may guess the answer. Dressed in multicolor patches, harlequin is the jester of traditional Italian comedy. The male duck with the jester's name is just as striking, with his slate-blue feathers and vivid white, black, and chestnut markings. The rigorous lives of harlequins require great adaptability, transitioning from freshwater to salt, from meals of caddisfly larvae to crabs and barnacles. Some, in fact, migrate by traveling directly downstream from the mountains to the ocean. Constant, however, is their unmatched ability to swim and feed in the turbulent waters where they live. BirdNote advisors include Bob Sundstrom, Heidi Ulsh, Dennis Paulson, and Gordon Oriens. I'm Mary McCann.
About 10 minutes to 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News. We're in the middle of Juneau afternoon. My guests are folks from Juneau Douglas High School and from Thunder Mountain High School. Debbie Banaszak is here and Terry Calvin to talk about the college fair that's coming up Friday.
Friday, yes.
So this event's been going on for a while. You've had college fairs at JDHS for roughly forever.
Yes, roughly forever. Somebody asked me the other day to give a date, and I honestly couldn't give you one. It's been going on for as long as I know. And of course, Debbie's had it happening at Thunder Mountain since Thunder Mountain opened up.
Uh-huh.
We usually rotate year after year. So this year, the college fair is at JDHS. Whereas last year it was out at Thunder Mountain. So people remember you're coming to JDHS this year and not out to Thunder Mountain.
So how do students from TMHS get to the fair? Do they get a hall pass or something?
Gosh, it's more than a hall pass. That's what I've been spending the last week doing, is tracking down those last 25 students without bus permission slips to go to JDHS. But yes, we're going to be busing about 350 students from Thunder Mountain High School in the 11th and 12th grade, and also our AVID students, which is a fairly new program at the high schools, will be busing the 9th and 10th grade AVID students to JDHS as well.
Okay, so what happens at a college fair?
It's actually a quite a nice time for the students to come and visit with multiple colleges in one setting. So instead of traveling all over the U.S., visiting campuses to see all different schools, they have them all in one spot. This year we have about 80 reps from different colleges around the U.S. coming to our gym on Friday. It's set up in a table setting, so we have tables set up throughout the main gym, and students just go from table to table and connect with any of the reps that they'd like to learn more about their school.
So if a student is interested in one particular school and wants to talk to that rep, is there like a directory or something like that to help them find their way around?
So, yes, there is a program that will be at the main entrance as they come in, and it has a map of where each of the schools are, so that a student will know where that's table is going to be set up. If students are interested in finding out what schools have already signed up, they can go to the JDHS website, go to the Career Center site, and I have a list of schools that have RSVP'd and are planning on being there. So they can kind of map out their own little ideas. They look through and say, okay, I'm going to have, you know, an hour. I want to see these 10 schools because these are the ones that interest me.
I noticed a couple of years ago that this was called the Career and Job Fair, or a Career and College Fair. Is this is it just a college fair now? Has it focused down to that thing?
Well, it's really a little bit of
just
both. It's mostly colleges and universities, but we do have some community colleges coming, and along with that, we also have some technical colleges like Universal Technical Institute, WyoTech, the ABTech, which is the Alaska Vocational Technical School. So there's technical schools, there's military people there. So, you know, anything we can do to help students think about post-secondary education or work.
And to add on to that, with that, the Alaska Commission of Post-Secondary Education is actually going to be there as well to kind of give a little extra insight of maybe give some knowledge on how to afford school. You know, what do we need to do to start looking at paying for that?
Which is a major issue, perhaps a little less of a major issue for a lot of Alaskan students who set their pipeline dividends aside, because there's quite a nice program for being able to do that and let it build up into a 529 plan for paying for college.
Absolutely. And on top of that, the Alaska Governor's Performance Scholarship comes in real handy for students who choose to stay in the state of Alaska. Any student who qualifies for the Alaska Performance Scholarship and stays in the state gets the benefit. There's three different tiers to that scholarship program, so it's not just the brightest students. It's open to any student who has scored well on their SATs, has completed a course goal that they've set, as well as a good GPA. So that's a great access for students that the governor has afforded our students to stay in the state to go to school here.
I'm assuming that packets have gone out so that parents are aware that their students are going to be doing this on Friday. Is that?
So we've been doing PR at JDHS, unlike at Thunder Mountain, where they're busing all their kids, and we have the afternoon session. And since it's on our home court, we can get more students coming in throughout the afternoon. But also, there is a public session that's open from 5 to 6 o'clock. It's open to any students and their parents if they choose to come in and take a look around. And for that matter, no parent will be denied at any point during the day. So as long as we're open and the reps are at their tables, a parent is more than welcome to come in and walk around.
Look the situation over a little bit.
Yeah, and the evening session is kind of nice. It's a little quieter, so it's a little nicer for students and parents to have a conversation together with some of the college reps.
Parking is a little bit of a problem around the high school. You got to watch the signs and make sure that you're not parking someplace where you shouldn't. Everybody needs to know, I think, about the pool reserved area and like that. But I think in the evening session, the faculty parking would be open for folks to park in if they wanted to. Is that right?
Very good point. Absolutely. Yes, do not park in the pool parking lot and also not over in the harbor parking lot. Sometimes people park in the harbor parking lot and take the skywalk across, and CBJ will give you a ticket for parking over there. And we're also sharing the parking spaces with our college representatives that are here as well, so it even limits our parking a little bit more.
Right, but well worth fighting your way through the parking if you need to in order to get to the fair. And it starts what time?
We will have the doors open at 9:45 in the morning and run till 11:30. And then we're going to give them a little bit of a break, and we'll go again starting at 1 o'clock to 3:45. Again, another bit of a break, and then again from 5 to 6.
Okay. Good enough. So the college fair at JDHS this year, students will be bussed over from TMHS, and the event is coming up right away. It's this Friday, and everyone that wants to go had better get themselves together for this thing, right?
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for bringing us up to date on this.
Thank you.
Thank you. Wasayati, we kushit laha, we kushit laha, a qua ke a seek away, who away, who away, a do seeks away, ya ye nach yon de yon.
Little Clinket background music there off of this wonderful Walking Between Worlds album by Littlefield. We're listening to a song that I played actually when my guest last week was on. It's a girl's lullaby in Clinket. So tomorrow on Juno Afternoon, Andy Klein will be in to host, and Roblin Gray Davis is going to be here talking about a workshop for Storytellers Saturday. The Grindhouse Liberation Film Festival is on, and you'll have a guest to talk about that. Bob Task will be here with a presentation about the World Affairs Council about international politics and seafood. Kate Savage from NOAA with the Wildlife Wednesday talk at UAS will join us, and Becky Janes and Ryland Bell will highlight tomorrow's Juno premiere of the latest film from Teton Gravity Research. Writer's Almanac, music, and more, all that happens tomorrow again on Juno Afternoon. This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We also broadcast on these translators in the Valley and Auk Bay. We're on K276 AF, that's at 103.1 MHz. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, our signal clears up a little bit at 101.7 on K269 AO. Gustavus hears us at 88.1 on K201 AM. K220 BT is the translator serving Hoonah at 91.9. And Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, we're heard on K210 AS, which is on 89.9 MHz. You can also hear us by tuning your digital channel 871 on GCI Cable Juno, and KRNN is on 872, KXLL is on 873, and we're streaming continuously on www.ktoo.org. Pat Moore, your host today for Juno Afternoon. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you again tomorrow. Oh, actually, Andy will see you again tomorrow. I'll see you again Friday.